Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey is just back from near the border of Ukraine, and as Russia's war there enters the third month, he wants something. Wider doors in America for Ukrainians fleeing the violence. Now, more than 5 million people have fled Ukraine since Russia's invasion began in late February. Most of them, primarily women and children, have flooded into nearby European countries. The U.S. has said it will accept up to 100,000 refugees from Ukraine. Senator Markey wants more, and he's here with us today. Welcome back, Senator Ed Markey.
No, it's great to be back with you again. Thank you.
Great to have you. I want to start with this trip. You paid a visit to the Ukrainian border with Poland. You went to Germany, India, the UAE. Take us there to Poland for a moment. Who and what did you see?
Well, in Poland, I met with our military leaders, the 82nd Airborne, who are responsible for taking all of the weapons which we are providing and the EU nations are providing, and finding routes, multiple routes into Ukraine so that there are resources for the Ukrainians to use in order to fight the Russians. It was very impressive. And in fact, if I were a Russian commander, I would be concerned.
What impressed you about it?
About the will of the Ukrainian people and the tools which they're going to be given in order to resist this inhumane invasion of Ukraine by the Russians.
And what was so impressive for you, Senator?
The coordinated effort that the 82nd Airborne had put together. And nations from around Europe were there as well, but with the United States in the lead, ensuring that there was 100% coordination. And from my perspective, I think it showed a resolve by the United States to support the Ukrainian people, that General Austin and Secretary Blinken was able to repeat when they met with President Zelensky over the weekend. I think our actions gave credibility to the promises that were being made by our leaders over the weekend.
So you return home calling for us to open our doors wider, accept more Ukrainians into the country. Was that something you wanted before you made the trip, or was there something you saw there, Senator, that made you say, oh, we have to do this differently?
Well, I introduced legislation 3 years ago looking to raise our refugee cap much higher than it had been historically. I think given what we see from Afghanistan and from other countries, that's our moral responsibility. But what I saw in Poland was a country that is the Poles, which are about one-ninth the size of the United States, taking 3 million Ukrainians in. And when we met with the Romanians, with the Hungarians, with the Slovakians, with the Czechs in Brussels, it was clear that each of those countries were willing to take in hundreds of thousands of refugees. And from my perspective, the United States should take in as many refugees as they want to come to our country, because these are people who, for the most part, don't want to stay. They need a refuge while the war is being fought. And the intention of 90 to 95% of them is to return to Ukraine after the war has been won.
I wanted to pick that up with you, because is there anything logistically complicated or dangerous isn't the right word, but there's an inertia when one is further away from home, right? So now you're crossing into a new continent, you're crossing an ocean. Our resettlement programs here tend to be geared towards helping people stay longer term. Any concern or thought that that actually makes it harder for people to get back home quickly and easily?
Well, you raise a good point, because in Poland, what we saw was a systematic plan that the Polish people have put together to put every single Ukrainian child who is a refugee in school. And they've done it in the first 8 weeks. And to be finding jobs for the Ukrainians. And they've done it all in the first 8 weeks. So to the extent to which, if we compare what we do to what the Polish people are doing, the work we have to do is obviously still there. But I think the Biden administration has demonstrated the needed flexibility on admitting Ukrainians. And we then have to implement a plan here to make sure they get into schools, the children get into school systems. And I know that children are being admitted into the schools of the United States right now. We just have to do a better job.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago, 3 years filing legislation to welcome more refugees into the country. You mentioned Afghanistan and that. I want to come back to that, because I'm sure you're aware that since the beginning of this invasion, there's been a criticism that Ukrainians are, by and large, representative of a white Western European country, and that we are having a different approach, that the West is taking a different approach to people fleeing conflict there, a warmer-hearted approach than people of color who are escaping some other countries. And I want to hear your response to that.
Well, I filed my legislation to dramatically raise the refugee cap long before the Ukrainian crisis, before anyone thought there was going to be a Ukrainian crisis. So I agree. We need to reflect the inscription of Emma Lazarus on the base of the Statue of Liberty. That's how my grandparents came here from Ireland. We have to have that same attitude, not just towards white Europeans, but for countries of any nature that have a crisis within them, from Latin America, from Afghanistan, no matter where it is. We should be more generous. And in looking at the Polish people, it's going to be a good example for what the United States should do in the future for every country in the world. We are the wealthiest country in the world. We have to demonstrate the generosity of spirit that has long characterized who we are.
So let's bring it home to Massachusetts now. With this 100,000 cap, do you know what percentage or what number Massachusetts can expect to embrace and welcome? Governor Baker has made it very clear that people will be welcome here.
I don't know the specifics, but I do know in talking, for example, to the mayor of Worcester, that they've rolled out the red carpet for Afghan refugees. And he told me that they're doing the same thing for Ukrainians, that if people want to come, they're more than willing to welcome them. And the number, I think, is going to be dependent upon who wants to come to Massachusetts as opposed to other states in the union. But I do think the message the governor is sending, the mayor of Worcester, other communities, is the right one. Just letting people know that if they need a place during this crisis in Ukraine, that Massachusetts will be a welcoming home for them for as long as is necessary.
So we talked recently with Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan, who had made a trip to the area. You've made this trip. You were part of a delegation. What is the purpose during conflict of our elected representatives physically going to the region? What does that bring home? What's the goal?
Well, number one, it's to reaffirm America's commitment to protecting the security of our friends in the world, continuing our support for Ukraine, and that we will help to meet the vast humanitarian needs in the region. I talked to many Ukrainian refugees in Poland to hear directly from them what they need from the United States and European partners, and then I have brought that message back to Washington as we continue to assess the assistance that that this region is going to need for an extended period of time.
So how do you think about when you go, understanding that you're headed into an area where there's a crisis going on, how do you think about not taking up resources during that visit? I mean, you're important. You represent the national security here in the United States. And this is, you know, this always comes up. How do you think about not absorbing resources that could be focused on work on the ground while you're there? What steps do you take?
Well, I think it's important for Senator Cory Booker, who I went with. He and I serve on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and Senator Mark Kelly, they serve on Senate Armed Services. For us to hear from the humanitarian relief community and to hear from our military what else they might need, so we can bring that directly back to Washington, D.C., and that's what we're doing this week. So the legislation necessary to provide the funding to accomplish these goals is directly tied to the level of knowledge and, as a result, passion, which senators can bring to that task so that it's expedited, so that we telescope the time frame, that we make sure we're dealing with the real needs in real time.
Is there a family or person that you met during your trip, or whose story you were told if you were mostly meeting with, you know, officials and military personnel, that's kind of sticking with you that you can tell us about to bring us there for a moment?
Well, I met one woman who had fled from Bucha, and she had taken her niece with her, and they were in a large dormitory-like room with about 20 other beds. It was a facility for 250 people. A Polish businessman had donated his building, which has been turned into a dormitory. And so I asked her about what had happened in Bucha. Obviously, it was a horrific event in her family's life. And then I asked her, where is her husband? And she said to me, my husband and my father are back still in Ukraine fighting. And in a way, that's like the summary in that one woman story of what is happening all across Ukraine. It is that the families are divided. The mothers, the aunts, the grandmothers are taking the children with them to other countries. And the men are staying behind with weapons that are now being provided from the West in order to ultimately defeat the Russian incursion.
Do you have one more minute to spend with us?
Sure.
So stepping back now, we've been specifically talking about opening the doors here in the United States to families who are seeking refuge. And you talked a little bit about, you know, legislation now in response to the war. What's your read on the posture that the United States is taking? You know, this is a fine line that we are walking. What's your read on the overall posture of the United States? And is there anything you'd like to be seeing us do more of or less of in this moment?
I think we have to continue to increase our support for humanitarian relief, increase our the number of refugees that come to our country, so there's no barrier to their entry. Continue to give the resources to the Ukrainian military so they can fight this war. But I also think that the United States has to really make a firm commitment to backing out all of the oil that is imported into the United States. We've done that, but we have to move to an all-electric vehicle future. For every 15 million all-electric vehicles which we deploy, it backs out all the Russian oil. The next 15 million all-electric vehicles we deploy would back out all the Saudi oil. And we now have to partner with the Europeans so that we destroy the business model of Russia and Middle Eastern countries that have us addicted to their imported fossil fuels. That is, from my perspective, the big lesson I'm taking away from this. Russia could not fight this war if the United States and Europe were sending hundreds of billions of dollars a year to pay for imported oil and gas. They could not afford their tanks, their planes, their armaments without the cooperation of the West, because we refuse to move to an all-electric future.
All right, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, just back from a trip to Europe. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, great to be with you. Thank you.
Boston has lifted pandemic restrictions on businesses, but many office workers haven't really returned yet. The city's trying to lure people back with a series of block parties throughout the summer, and WBUR's Walter Wuthman reported from Downtown Crossing, where the first gathering was held recently.
If you offer them coffee, they will come, or at least that's the hope. It's all part of the effort to bring back remote workers. The city has plenty of other ideas as well.
We're bringing fife and drum troops in. We're bringing historical reenactors in. We're just trying to make sure people understand that downtown Boston is clean, safe, and welcoming.
That's George Camo, marketing and brand manager for the Boston Downtown Business Improvement District.
I hope people will think about all the things they did love about downtown Boston and decide to come back.
The nonprofit is working with Mayor Michelle Wu to hold a series of parties on Wednesdays to try to boost downtown's appeal. Local officials say businesses need the workers to return to survive. About 13% of downtown offices are now vacant, more than double the figure before the pandemic. And foot traffic is less than half of what it was in 2019, according to sensors operated by the Downtown Business Improvement District. Some office workers, like Ellie Dieter, said they appreciated the effort to revive downtown. Dieter was one of the people waiting in line for free coffee at the Mobile Dunkin'.
I like feeling a little bit like a person again, you know, rather than just rolling out of bed and walking 5 feet to my desk.
Dieter says she started working in person at her downtown office again in February. But she says it will take more than free coffee and other perks to draw all the people back. She says companies also need to do more to make employees feel safe.
Making sure that there is space or precautions in place that people can, you know, help themselves feel good about coming back in with the help of their company.
Brian Appleman is a real estate agent who works in the area. He says some of his favorite local restaurants still feel mostly empty.
We go to lunch all the time down here, and it's been a bummer to see some of the places struggling that you're usually seeing lines out the door, you know?
Democracy Brewing is a microbrewery steps away from Downtown Crossing.
So right now we're brewing a sour. Mike, what are you brewing right now?
That's Democracy co-founder James Raza. Head brewer Mike Smith is just downstairs, stirring a mango papaya sour. Democracy was once a popular spot for drinks after work. But Raza says the office workers have yet to come back in large numbers. Instead, they've mostly seen tourists and other visitors. But Raza says he finally feels like his brewery is on solid footing again after struggling through the lockdowns.
We definitely thought game was up a few times, for sure. And we felt like if we could hang on, things would get better.
Raza says he's also happy for all the bars, cafes, and restaurants that have managed to survive so far. And he hopes business keeps getting better for everyone.
The more that we can have downtown rebounding and being exciting again, the more that people are going to want to come visit and pop around and get drinks here, then go to a show and then get dinner there. And so I think it's starting to really come back, and that's super exciting for us.
Back on the street, theater workers Lucille Ferragamo and Karen Costco say they've been putting on shows in person since last summer, well ahead of many office workers. Here's Ferragamo.
Well, we've been alive right from the beginning.
Well,
we went right back to work. We're at the theaters, uptown, downtown, and once they opened the doors, put the curtain up, we were there in the aisle.
But not everyone came back as quickly. Costco said the streets still felt empty a few months ago.
Yeah. And do you see people starting to come back a little more?
Absolutely, especially
to
the
theaters.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, they're craving
it. They need it.
The Boston Improvement District sensors back that up. Though still down from 2019, foot traffic has surged 64% over the past year. The city wants to boost those numbers even further, so they'll keep trying with street performers, food trucks, and free iced coffee.
That report from WBUR's Walter Wuthman. Duxbury, Woburn, Danvers. The litany of scandals over racism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, bullying in high school sports has grown over the past year. On that list, Wayland and Westford. Earlier this year, a 17-year-old basketball player at Wayland High School was subject to racist slurs and taunts from students in the bleachers during a game with a neighboring school, Westford Academy. In response, Wayland Public Schools decided to cancel all its games with Westford for the rest of the season. The two districts are in the same sports conference. Superintendent Omar Easy of Wayland Public Schools made the call. He's a former college and NFL fullback, playing at Penn State, drafted by Kansas City Chiefs, finishing his career with the Oakland Raiders. Omar Easy joins us now. Welcome, Superintendent Easy.
Yes, hi. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate having you. Tell us what happened at the basketball game.
Well, you know, it seems like it's so long ago, right? And this actually happened sometime in January 31st of this year. And, you know, it was just really insensitivity and just derogatory racial remarks that were made towards one of our female athletes. And, you know, I got the information and just thought that, you know, what was proposed was just not enough to try to curb the behavior and or educate our young people as to how we should behave towards each other.
What was the proposal?
So, I mean, I think the other districts, school district, decided to suspend fans from going to the games for, I think, a couple of days. I'm not sure exactly what it was. You know, and to me, that wasn't enough, right? We need to make a bigger statement around how we can move forward and how we can educate our young people as to how to behave with each other. So
I do want to pick up on then what you decided to do, but before I do, how is that student athlete now? How's she doing?
You know, she's doing well. She's doing well. I've conversed with her a few times. I've been in touch with her mother and her father and her grandmother. In fact, we are scheduled to meet sometime this week or next week just to kind of check in to see where things are and kind of give the family an update as to where we are and how things are progressing.
So then you took a pretty bold move. You pull out of competitions with Westford. Now, I want to note it's your first year in the job. You are a black superintendent in a town where more than 80% of the population is white. That was a big move.
You know, I guess I'm hearing that, but, you know, I didn't view it that way. I just, you know, for me, I feel like I'm morally and ethically responsible to disrupt the status quo, right? And the status quo is to kind of, you know, apologize and we're sorry this happened and this should never happen. There's no place in our sports. But then nothing comes from that, right? And I feel as though in order for us to do something and to educate our communities, right, around what's acceptable, I am responsible morally and ethically to make a stand as to what we are going to accept as Wayland Public Schools. I needed to make a stand as to how my kids, there are my kids, all 2,700 plus of them, they're my kids, how and where they go when they compete in other communities, how safe that environment should be. So it's my responsibility to model for them what I expect.
So how did families react?
You know, my community was very supportive. You know, really, I didn't, there weren't many, if any, negative comments, at least not to me. I honestly say, you know, the emails that I got from my community was just, it was really such a support that I found. It was like, oh my God, it was so deeply felt that folks believed that they were like, I'm supportive of your decision. Oh my God, that's a really, you know, stand up move. We support you 100%. Thank you for doing that. That's kind of what, you know, the support has been from our community, from our families.
How? So it was good. How has your own experience as an athlete influenced how you're approaching this now?
You know, I think sports as a whole brings people from all walk of life together. I mean, you think of the Olympics or the World Cup, right? The sporting events, right? And I think it gives young people a chance to express themselves, you know, on the field or on a court or in a team camaraderie, right? And, you know, if folks are not accountable for his or her individual responsibility on the sporting field or in the court, then there's no team, right? And I think, you know, for me, going through high school and experience racism when I was in high school, right, and being called the N-word, and, you know, and managed to maintain my composure and just respond to that type of behavior with the scoreboards, right, by beating the team or whatever it looks like, right? And going through college and being a professional athlete, you know, I really appreciate sports as a learning tool and a tool that brings folks together. So I felt really badly for my young female athlete that she had to endure that type of behavior for an entire football game, right? I mean, sorry, entire basketball game. But, you know, I was disappointed by the adults. And I think that's where, you know, I have an issue with how the adults behave.
So,
the adults behave badly.
Floating in the back of my mind, Superintendent Easy, is Penn State. And for our listeners who, so you were a football player there in the late 1990s. For our listeners who don't know, Penn State was racked with scandal after a part of the coaching team, Jerry Sandusky, who coached through 1999, was found guilty of sexually abusing 10 boys in 2012. You later served for just a little bit on the football staff there. How did your experiences there and what happened to the program, what's happened in the years since, the legendary coach there, Joe Paterno, retired and then was fired, how did that influence how you see your responsibilities as an administrator now?
You know, and that didn't, I would say, didn't really influence my decision as much as one would think, because for me, you know, I have to be an upstander, not a bystander, right, as a superintendent of schools. And one of my sole responsibilities is the safety and well-being of all kids, right? So being attacked racially is not providing a safe environment for young people. So, you know, when I was at Penn State, and as you mentioned, Sandusky was a coach there. I was a young athlete trying to find my way around a university with 45,000 young people, right? And that was challenging in itself, and also trying to navigate the scope of student athlete performance. So it's those were at that time didn't really, you know, resonate with me in the sense that I wasn't aware of any of what was happening, right? So it didn't really impact me as much as the fact that as I grow older, became more educated and being more responsible for young people. I know what my moral compass is, right? I know what my responsibilities are. And it was easy for me to act in a way that I need to protect every student. It doesn't matter what ethnic background they are. But, you know, in this particular case, our female athletes are just student of color. And those hateful and insensitive remarks was hurtful, not just to her, but to me as a person of color.
So will you play the Westford schools next year?
Well, so our plan is, right, is to take this spring and implement a process where Westford and Wayland will engage in restorative and social justice seminars during the time when we were scheduled to play each other. So as opposed to be a baseball or lacrosse game, we'll have these restorative circles where we can talk about what happened, what we need to do, how we get better. And it's really a learning experience from our point of view. We need to use this to educate our young people, right?
Yep.
The future of our nation, right? And it's not to chastise Westford and say, oh, you're done, you're no good to the society. That's not the intent, right? Because we're dealing with young people. The intent is to how do we educate them about the insensitivity of their behavior,
Yes.
Right? Because we come to find out that these students who were being so rude towards one of our student athletes, they're also student athletes. So it's even more impactful that they understand how deeply its impact our community, their community, and the individual students.
So we'll end it there. Superintendent Omar Easy of the Wayland Public Schools, really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
So for more on this now, Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey joins us. Attorney General Healey, welcome.
Oh, good afternoon.
So you have, since these incidents across the state, you have launched a collaboration, excuse me, I'm going to clear my throat, with the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, some associations that represent public and private high schools, superintendents, administrators, to address all of this. Why take that action? Why do it now? How is this resonating with you?
Well, it was interesting listening to Superintendent Easy. I mean, I come from this from a couple of perspectives, Tiziana. I am an attorney general, a civil rights lawyer. I'm also somebody who has played a lot of sports in her life. I was a professional athlete, played in college, and played a lot of sports through high school. They're very important to me. But unfortunately, over the last several months, I saw too many incidents of racism, bigotry, homophobia, on playing fields, in hockey rinks, in locker rooms, reports to my office, and also things that I'd seen covered in the news. And I just thought we needed to do something about it. And so my office recently created these partnerships, hosted a call to action event with more than 400 people participating. And this is all about empowering superintendents, principals, athletic directors, coaches, referees, and others to help build positive, supportive, and inclusive cultures on teams and in school communities. And we've got a lot of programming, including trainings and conferences coming up through the summer.
And what's the uptake? What are you hearing from districts around the state? Are they throwing their hats and saying, we want this?
I think absolutely. And we're lucky to be partnering with the Northeastern Center for the Study of Sport and Society, as well as the Massachusetts Interscholastic Athletic Association. You know, they see it. It's happening in their districts. It's happening in their schools. I think it is, in some respects, very much a product of what students are seeing, modeled by parents and adults out there. And, you know, the fact of the matter is we have seen a really unfortunate rise in hate, bigotry, outward displays of these things in recent years. And it's definitely now filtered its way into youth sports. And the incidents, I mean, that have been reported, whether it's up in Danvers or down in Duxbury, or you spoke about the Westford Academy incidents, these are happening with frequency around the state. And we absolutely need to get a handle on it. And this is about empowering adults with the tools and the resources they need to help young people make the smart decisions, to make sure there are ways for accountability, and to make sure that we're moving forward in a way that we're educating and working with one another to root out this really, really unfortunate, hateful, and racist conduct that we're seeing all too often in places.
Did this stuff happen when you were in high school?
You know, it's probably always been there in society throughout, you know, throughout time. That said, I have not seen, as somebody who's played a lot of youth sports, coached a lot of youth sports, been involved in the youth sports, I have to say the level of what we see right now is something I've never seen before.
And where do you think that's coming from?
I think it's unfortunately a product of our times right now. And you know, the ugly language and rhetoric that we see on display in places around, you know, the country and national dialogue, these things have their effect, and it's almost like some feel more licensed to say certain things. But I want to be really clear. I want to be really clear that in Massachusetts, it's unacceptable, you know, and I'm all for sports as a way to help empower young people, really, really great lessons that you can learn from sports. And I just want people to be able to comfortably participate and to enjoy those experiences. But you know, the idea is that students would be taunted with racist language, either from student peers or from adults in some instances. It's just completely unacceptable. That's why we're putting this on.
Yeah, with that in mind, I do want to ask you, you know, should something like what you're doing, the trainings, the regional trainings that the Center for Sport and Society will run, those are train the trainer events, or the pilot that the Massachusetts Interscholastic Athletic Association is doing around DEI training and a pledge, should any of that be mandatory? Should this be a stick, or is a carrot more important? I know that the head of the training, Dan Leibowitz, has said he thinks the carrot approach is more important. I'm interested in your take.
Well, I think my hope is that all schools will sign up, including, you know, taking advantage of those trainings and those programs. But also my office did recently, guidance to assist schools and communities on their efforts to keep bias and hate out of sports. So my hope is that all would want to take this up. Certainly it's important, you know, that there be buy-in by districts to do this. I believe that buy-in is there. I think that we recognize the importance of addressing hate in our communities. And, you know, at this point, I'm not sure that it needs to be mandatory at all. I think that there's going to be, you know, based on the calls and the conversations that my team and I have had, I think that people are looking for this and wanting tools to try to help them.
So before I let you go, you have an ongoing investigation into what happened in Danvers, the district's handling of incidents with the 2020 hockey team around racist incidents, sexual abuse, hazing. Can you tell us anything about the status of that?
Well, we'll have more to say about that very soon. We've had good conversations with Danvers, and I am optimistic about the outcome there. I think, you know, zooming out a little, what this really reflects and comes down to for me is that our school leaders, our athletic coaches, our administrators need to, in the face of incidents like this, respond swiftly, be transparent, support victims. And it also, Tiziana, doesn't start with our schools. I mean, this to me gets back to community. It gets back to parents. You know, parents need to model and teach their kids not to hate, you know, not that it's unacceptable to engage in racist commentary or homophobic commentary or anti-Semitic commentary, you know, bigotry of any kind. It doesn't have any place in our locker rooms, our rinks, our playing fields, our schools, or our communities.
All right. That is Maura Healey, Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
All right. Stay with us. Coming up, do you know which bird is making that call? We'll dive into what you can expect to see and hear this spring right in your own backyard. That's after the break. I'm Tiziana Deering. You are listening to Radio Boston. I really enjoy these sounds. Listen, spring has sprung here in New England, and despite the cloudy skies outside today, we're in that warmer weather. Nature is upon us, and that's a big season for birds, both with those visiting on their way north and others who make the region home year-round. Here with us now to talk about what we can expect to see and hear this season, Neil Hayward. He is a lifelong birder, serves on the board of the Brookline Bird Club and the American Birding Association, and is author of the book Lost Among the Birds, Accidentally Finding Myself in One Very Big Year. Neil, welcome.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi, Neil. So glad to have you here. So listen, you sent some bird sounds over today. I loved them, and I want to start right there with one. Oh, we may not have it ready. There we go. There it is. Okay, so Neil, when I heard that sound, my first thought was, I hear that all the time. And when we previewed the sound earlier, Marquise in the control room, the first thing he said was, I hear that sound all the time. So tell us what were we just hearing?
That's a great one to start with. That's the state bird of Massachusetts, which is surprisingly not the turkey, but the black-capped chickadee. And you're right, it's kind of one of those sounds that is sort of the background to our lives. But if you're not paying attention, you may not notice.
And how prevalent is the bird? I have to admit, I couldn't even tell. Is that more than one bird making those sounds? Does the bird make a bunch of different calls? And how do we spot one in our own backyard, Neil?
So listening is the best way to find them. And they're singing now. The males are singing. That whistle call, descending whistle, is the male singing. They're pretty small. They're about 5 1/4 inches long, so a bit smaller than your cell phone. And they weigh about 2 dimes. These are tiny birds.
I'm sorry, dimes? Literally, like the weight of a couple of dimes.
Yeah, they've been with us the whole winter. And you may have heard them calling during the winter when they get their namesake, chickadee-dee-dee.
I love it. Okay, so you can tell I'm going to thoroughly enjoy the bird sounds here. I wanted to start with the chickadee, which is, as you say, native here, because turns out we're kind of a bird mecca in the Commonwealth. Tell us about that.
Yes, so this is a really special time of year for bird watchers. Migration involves about 3.5 billion birds crossing into the U.S. from Mexico, South and Central America. And Massachusetts is a great place to see many of those, especially warblers. We have about 35 different species of warbler. These are about 5 inches long, and they come in a bewildering array of colors and different songs. And for many of us, that's the highlight of spring migration.
All right, so you sent us sound for the Black Burnian warbler. Let's hear that. So you can almost kind of hear, Neil, why it's called a warbler. Of course, I'm making that up. It might be called that because somebody with the last name Warble found it. But you almost hear that warbling sound, right?
And that's one of the higher warbles. That's hard for some of us to hear. It's really at the top end of our hearing spectrum. These birds have made an incredible journey. These birds are coming from Peru and Bolivia, so 5,000 or 6,000 miles away to spend the summer, just a few months of the summer, up here in New England and up into Canada. And really these birds, we think of these birds as our birds that breed here and then they winter somewhere else. But it's better to think of them as us just borrowing them for a few months of the year. They spend their life pretty much in South and Central America. And for a few months of the year, they come here to breed and then they leave.
Might one see a Black Burnian warbler in any backyard in Massachusetts? Or is there like a specific habitat when they come here?
They're looking to refuel on their way north. So they're looking for any trees that have insects and caterpillars. Blossoming and leafing oak trees are great places to see them. And the more the better. If you can go to cemeteries such as Mount Auburn Cemetery or Forest Hills, parks like Franklin Park, Boston Public Common, Arnold Arboretum, and reservoirs, Chestnut Hill Reservoir, Fresh Pond, all those are great places to see some of these birds.
All right, so I want to play another one now that I think will be very familiar for people. When I hear that, Neil, I get sort of an adrenaline rush because I associate it with morning. When I get up and I got everything I got to do. Tell us who that is.
Well, I think that same adrenaline rush is also experienced by female cardinals when they hear the male singing that song. This is, of course, the northern cardinal. Many of your listeners will be familiar with this bird. It's bright red male with a black face and a predominant crest. Females, I think, are more subtle, but in many ways more pretty, kind of brownish red with red in the tail and red on the crest. Almost 9 inches long. Very loud, and you're right, singing almost continuously in the mornings these days.
So I like this going back and forth between birds that are, I don't know if I'm using the right term, Neil, in saying indigenous here, but really local birds, and birds who pass through. So I'm going to play another one here. This is the chimney swift. There's something so peaceful about that. That's a passer-through, right?
Yeah, these birds, they haven't arrived yet. They'll be arriving probably next week at the beginning of May. And they're brown. They fly high in the sky. They look a bit like flying cigars.
I know what you're talking about.
And very loud, high-pitched twittering. They spend almost their entire life on the wing. And they can't perch. They have their feet are structured so they can cling onto the sides of buildings and chimneys, which is predominantly where they nest. Birds have come from the Amazon basin, like the Black Burnian warbler, just for a few months of the year up here.
So they're mostly flying all the time, except when they're in a nest?
Correct, yes. They're catching their food on the wing.
And it also strikes me that you had fairly great certainty, Neil, that they're not here yet. They'll be here next week. I mean, do birds really migrate with that level of punctuality?
They have to. So there's a real balance in terms of getting here too early or too late. Birds want to get here and set up territories and breed. If they get here too early, then there's no food for them and they'll die. If they get here too late, then all the best territories have gone. So they're trying to time that. And interestingly, that's something, that sort of clockwork mechanism has been affected by climate change. Hmm. It's thought that every decade now, birds are arriving 1 to 2 days earlier than they have in the past. And that's because trees are blossoming earlier, insects are coming out earlier, birds are nesting earlier than they have in the past. And also birds are expanding their ranges northward. So going back to that northern cardinal that you played earlier, that's a bird that was a rarity in Massachusetts. We think of them as these birds that we see all the time.
But really?
The first record of a breeding cardinal in Massachusetts was 1961 in Wellesley, before which they were really rare. Now they're everywhere. They've expanded their range up the East Coast, up into northern New England.
All right, so as we wrap, I want to hear one more bird, just because we can. Am I saying it correctly? The red-eyed vireo?
Good job. The red-eyed vireo. A fairly nondescript bird with a very big bill that's hooked, a bit like a red-tailed hawk. And this is a bird that will sing to itself all day. It'll sing, "Where am I? Here I am. In the tree. Look up here. At the top." And that's where most of the birds are, at the top. They're looking for caterpillars. And it uses that hooked bill to pick caterpillars out of their little hidey holes.
All right. Well, Neil Hayward, this is a treat. You are a lifelong birder, serves on the board of the Brookline Bird Club and the American Birding Association, and author of the book, Lost Among the Birds, Accidentally Finding Myself in One Very Big Year. Neil, thanks so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks, Tiziana.
Funding for WBUR's environmental coverage comes from An Unlikely Story Bookstore and Cafe in Plainville, believing that where you shop shapes where you live, with books, games, cards, decor, and more for specific interests such as the environment and climate change. In-person and live virtual events, more at anunlikelystory.com.
All right, folks, so we are wrapping the show today, and as we do, I have some news to share with you. Get ready for more Radio Boston on air, online, and on your phone when you text us. So listen closely. I'm excited to tell you this. You knew we were working on a special project. You've heard us asking you to sign up to text with us. Well, it's all coming together now. Starting Monday, May 9th, our show will be live at 11 a.m. You'll still be able to listen every weekday at 3, and we're expanding ways for you to connect with us. Listen, stay tuned for more details about our inaugural week as it comes, but we are excited to share that news with you. Starting May 9th, we'll be live at 11 a.m., or you can catch us again at 3.